Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week we're seriously considering if this is all a simulation. I mean, how else do you explain the last few years? Justin Cronin is on hand to help explore this and other existential queries. As you almost certainly know, Justin is the author of the landmark epic trilogy, The Passage. Like many of you, I loved it, but I love his new book more. The Ferryman is a thick slice of classic sci-fi. It's recognisable in shape, but very different in detail. It's complicated, so I'll let Justin give you the synopsis. But just know that, though it would sit on the sci-fi shelves, at its heart is the chilling question, what the hell is reality anyway? As well as that philosophical nightmare, we also talk about the power of the unconscious, the terror of infinity, and how mortal peril is a useful novelistic tool. Yeah, we go pretty deep this week. I had such a good time talking to Justin. If you enjoy this kind of thing, well, you can support Talking Scared by subscribing, by sharing, by reviewing, that's a massive deal, or by signing up for Patreon. You just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod or use the link in the show notes. You'll get tons of bonus episodes, including a brand new hour-long dissection of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which I undertook with my university lecturer, Professor Simon James. And that conversation is the first time we've spoken in 20 years. But that's a different episode. I hope you listen to it. But for now, come with me to a gleaming city by the sea. If you hear the foghorn blow, that's the sign that your life may be coming to a close. Let's talk scared. Well, hi, Justin, and a massive welcome to Talking Scared.
Oh, thanks for having me.
No problem. How are you today? Where are you speaking to us from?
I am in Houston, Texas, where I spend about half the year, and I teach at a university here.
Are you from Texas originally?
No, I'm from mostly Cape Cod, which is in Massachusetts, which is where I spend, maybe a little bit less than half the year.
Right, okay. This is research I should clearly have done, but when you said Texas, I was a bit thrown, because in my head you are very much a sort of northeastern writer. I think it's my prejudice about all horror in the US coming from a certain part of the country, which is obviously completely wrong.
Yes, it all comes from Salem.
Yeah.
We're all really Hawthorne. Hawthorne and Poe.
Yeah, a lot of people in Utah just stopped listening right away. Anyway, at the time of recording, we are a few weeks out from your brand new novel, The Ferryman, hitting bookshelves. And let's be honest, it's an event, because it's your first book since 2016 when you completed The Passage trilogy. So I suppose to start, how are you feeling as publication approaches?
Oh, I don't know. Having a book actually, become a hard rectangular object in the world is always kind of a shock, really, as much as anything else. I mean, it's been something I've been, living with the story for 5 years as a sort of abstraction, something in my head, a bunch of words on a page. And then all of a sudden it's done in a way where you can't change anything. You never have to write the book again, but you also can't. So, it's an exciting time. I'm always happy to, to have, another thing sort of in the can. And I'm really interested in seeing what people think of this book, because it's in some ways, it's a little bit different from The Passage. I mean, I think that's fair to say.
We'll get into that for sure. But I always wonder if this is a rude question to ask, so apologies in advance. But why has it been so long between books for you? Because you wrote The Passage, that's a lot of words, and then it's been 8 years. Yeah. Have you been working on this all that time, or has something else gotten? What's been the situation?
Oh, when I was done with The Passage, The Passage is three books, but if you actually did a word count, it's the length of about nine books. Mm-hmm. Nine, more or less, it's about 900,000 words, somewhere between 900 and a million. And when it was all over, I was pretty spent for a little while, and I didn't want to just leap into something else. I was tired, and I also just wanted to see what would sort of organically rise in my imagination as the next project, my feeling is that you should write the book that's asking you to write it. I'm not a very tactical careerist. I kind of let things just sort of grow at their own pace. And I'm also a pretty slow writer. I mean, the passage towards the end, I was writing fairly quickly because I could. I was inside the same story for a decade and it had acquired a lot of sort of just natural momentum. But building something from the ground up took a little while. And this was also a very tricky book to write because it's a book that relies very much upon a big reveal. You know, mm-hmm. you're supposed to come to a moment in this novel where the top of your head flies off, and making sure that you've earned that right is a pretty complicated matter. I found myself doing draft after draft after draft, trying to make everything line up.
Well, having read it, having been lucky enough to read it in advance of its release, mm-hmm. I'll just say right up top that I think you've pulled it off masterfully. I adored this book. I tore through it I was away in Wales in like a really creepy cottage in the middle of nowhere with this book, and I just tore through it. And okay, right, it's not horror per se, but I would argue that it's full of a certain kind of existential and ontological nightmare, paranoia about reality itself and all that stuff. But that is something we're going to have to wrestle with today, because it's not. Well, every so often on this show, we have a book where we have to tread very carefully.
Right.
And it's not so much a case of spoiling a twist in the conventional sense with the Theremin. More that you've written this, as you said, with these layers of revelation that it would be an absolute crime to ruin for the reader. So at that point, I'm going to pass the ball to you to say, can you introduce this book and tell us a little bit of what it's about?
Okay, so yes, and I do have to tread very carefully. I can really pretty much give the setup and not much else. In terms of genre, you know, I'll start there. And I always like to work in several genres simultaneously. I mean, the Ferryman, to begin with, I'd say it's a thriller. It's a detective novel. It's a conspiracy novel. It's speculative fiction, kind of in the tradition of the golden age of sci-fi that I was raised on. The setup is this: at some distant future time, humanity, what remains of it, is living on an isolated island in a situation of really pretty spectacular luxury. It's a sort of top shelf life that they enjoy. And in fact, they do not even die. As the end of life approaches, and they live very long lives, 120 to 150 years, they board a ferry to a nearby island. And nobody knows what happens there, only that it does. They return shortly thereafter, remade as fresh-faced, vigorous, healthful teenagers with no memories at all of their previous lives, and get to live life all over again. And our main character, a man named Proctor Bennett, is a ferryman, the ferryman of the title, and his job is the many different layers involved with getting people on the ferry to take this voyage. He's sort of one part lawyer, because there's a lot of paperwork involved, and he's one part psychotherapist, guiding people psychologically and emotionally through the process, and then one part cop, because sometimes this has to be enforced if people don't want to get on the ferry. And it's a life he likes. He's valued by his community. He's feels rewarded and satisfied by the work that he does, until the day when he is asked to take his own guardian, his father, to the ferry, whereupon everything goes completely haywire, and the story's off and running as he is forced to try to uncover this sort of dark secret beneath this perfect world.
Believe it or not, listeners, that's like 5% of the story.
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
To start, do you have any clear memory of when, and I suppose why or how, this story first did rise to the top in your imagination? Do you have any sense of where it came from?
Well, I where it came from is one of those great mysteries of the unconscious and the imagination. But I do remember what happened. While I was writing the passage, I was working on the passage trilogy for about 10 years. And during that time, I would once in a while get a cool idea. I would get an idea for a novel, and I put it in something I called my cool idea book, where I would just write down the notes and say, yeah, that's pretty good. Maybe I'll do that. And then when I was done with the passage, I looked at the cool idea book, and all the ideas there did indeed seem very cool, but I had no real relationship to them. They weren't, you know, they were ideas and nothing more. I didn't really feel passionate about any of them. So I was kind of waiting, as I said, to see what would happen next. And one night on Cape Cod, a pretty starry night in autumn, I was taking a walk, and two things happened in rapid succession, which I can't quite explain, but nevertheless, it's what occurred. A word dropped into my head, and it was a word I did not know. And it seemed to come from nowhere at all. It is the word Ouranios, which becomes the sort of open sesame word of the novel. The word that makes, once you've heard that word, you're in trouble and you are trouble. And at the same time, a scene landed in my head, which was the scene of an elderly man on a pier having some kind of psychological meltdown and scaring the wits out of all the other people around him. And the word and the scene seemed to have something to do with each other, but I had no idea what it was. So I had to just kind of marinate in it for a while. And what I was doing was actually waiting for a third idea, a third thing to kind of collide with them. That's how my books tend to come about, is when things that don't seem necessarily to belong to one another suddenly have a kind of collision, producing a new sort of object. As I say, it's rather like atoms, you know, smashing into each other to make a molecule. And that other idea, I can't tell you what it is, because that's the big spoiler. that's the mystery behind it all. But when these things kind of came together in my head, I realized there was a book there. The other thing about me is that I need to know the ending before I start. And so I again sat with this for a little while until I really knew how it ended up, and so I could chart a course to get there.
Isn't it mad how that happens? It's almost like something is being beamed into your mind from some other place, like that strange word and then that abstract image, and then however many years later we get this thing.
I can't explain it.
Yeah. I've heard about that happening to other people. Stephen King talks about when he wrote The Langoliers, about having the image of a woman holding a crack together in the wall of an aeroplane.
Right.
And of course, that appears nowhere in the story, but that was the germination point. It must be a kind of wonderful, shattering thing when it happens.
Well, it's, you know, on the question of where it comes from, I don't really know the answer. I mean, I had a creative writing teacher way back in the day when I was in graduate school who said, you know, your job as a writer is to be sitting at the keyboard when it comes from above, which I thought was a very good use of, very good phrase. And, you know, these things come from some, you know, really some sort of deep stew inside your unconscious mind, I think, which your unconscious mind is where all the good stuff is.
Yeah.
You know, your conscious mind is just, you know, kind of just gets you through the day. But your unconscious mind is a realm of real genius, I think. And, you know, writers and artists, I think we're just people who are either blessed or cursed, depends on your point of view, with having that layer of the mind a little bit closer to the conscious mind, which, you know, we, as I said, for better or worse, sometimes it might be nicer not to live this way, but, you know, we can kind of tap into that stuff.
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, it's no secret that neurosis, you know, runs in parallel with creativity. And as you say, it's both blessing and curse. Yeah. To dive in to this, I first need to go back a little bit to contextualize this. The passage, because it has vampires, is generally considered a horror novel.
Right.
I don't know what you think. I mean, I think the passage is a big science fiction adventure, you know, that has horror inflection.
Right.
This, I think, is a big science fiction adventure with a different kind of horror element, which you may or may not even think is there. I certainly do.
Right.
When you were writing this, did you think of it as a change of tack? Was it a very different experience, or is it just writing to you regardless of what you're playing with?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. All writing feels in some ways the same, because your job is always the same, which is to be interesting and to create psychological plausibility in whatever scenario you've created. In that sense, I've always been a kind of literary writer where I put the characters first and think about them in terms of the truth of human complexity. You know, I always say a personality is your personal collection of contradictions. So that's kind of always in first position. When I started writing The Passage, and I'd written two, you know, substantially more quiet literary novels prior to that, I did wonder if when I suddenly, you know, moved to this epic canvas with a genre, you know, with a range of genres in play, I actually don't think of The Passage strictly as horror. That particular volume of the trilogy, I think of as a Western. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering if I would write differently. And the answer is no, I didn't. I had to learn to do new things. I had to learn to, for instance, write complicated action scenes, you know, which is something that is very hard to do on the page. And in fact, I haven't seen that many novels do it all that well. But when I sat down to write The Ferryman, I was once again writing a novel really about people in a circumstance. But I did not have the luxury of having my characters running for their lives at every minute of the day, which is in The Passage, that was, you know, that's the basic circumstance of the entire trilogy is mortal peril, you know, on the daily. And that is a great characterization tool. It's enormously efficient. If people are running for their lives, they cannot help but be themselves. Whereas The Ferryman, yeah, as I said, I didn't have that particular tool at work. So matters of plot and character ended up relying on some much more sort of subtle effects.
I mean, yeah, that thing about the propulsion of action and threat, it I get that, and how that isn't necessarily in this in the same way. But as different as the two books seem, I think there's something that connects them. And this is where I stray into pretension a bit, probably too early in this conversation. But both are arguably about the way we mythologize our past in order to understand our present. That's something I thought you always did right in The Passage. And almost, if this isn't too bold, to say that you could almost read both of these stories as about how new religions come to be. Is that too grand a claim?
No, it's not. I mean, the Passage trilogy is rather explicitly about how a human story over time becomes the foundation for a sort of cultural meaning, whether you call that a religion or a binding cultural mythology or a cultural pedigree. There are things in the past that were human things, ordinary people, that become larger than life and impart meaning and organization to societies. The best example, an easy one for you, would be how the story of King Arthur is part of the pedigree of the British monarchy, for instance. And, you know, King Arthur himself was probably a rather bad-smelling guy who lived on a dirt hill, who was nevertheless pretty good at sort of a local warlord who did a very good job sort of slowing down some of the Anglo-Saxon incursion into the British Isles and giving Celtic culture a little bit deeper of a toehold so that it could survive, right? But he was just a guy, you know? Passage takes up this question for a religion of the future 1,000 years down the road. In The Ferryman, this becomes part of the subject over time across the length of the book. And towards the end, a character actually raises this question quite explicitly. Mm. How will this be remembered? And so you're absolutely not wrong at all. And I'm delighted to see that you notice.
Well, what prompted that thought was that I was thinking, you've written two epic stories that are about huge swathes of time. Well, huge swathes of human time, at least, if not cosmic time. A lot of human time. And they both are also about the function of storytelling over a large expanse of time. And that's then led me to religion and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, is that something that you're generally interested in, how story functions over expanses of time?
Yeah, and this is in some ways kind of a personal question, a personal concern. I recently turned 60, which is a shock, let me tell you. It recently occurred to me that the unbelievably quaint and primitive world of my parents' childhood in the 1930s and 40s, right? For my children, that's my childhood. which is nevertheless enormously vivid to me. The the 60s and the 70s are to them what the 30s and 40s are to me. And we are always somebody's past. And the more time goes by, the deeper that past becomes. And in theory, time is, if not an infinite expanse, certainly of an expanse that is impossible for our limited intelligence to actually imagine. And this is, as I've gotten older and sort of a little less egotistical, I suppose, has become a matter that, I don't want to say obsesses me, but it's one that interests me rather deeply. Mm-hmm. As my children become adults and start to view me as more and more primitive and quaint, right? that, you get a feeling for how you're being shuffled off stage, as someday they will be shuffled off stage, and then their children will shuffle them off stage, and so on and so on and so on and so on. As I said, it's something that's kind of always in the back of my mind, and it started to kind of grow as my children grew. And they're now adults or adult-ish. My daughter's 26. My son's turning 20 this month. So when I was writing both stories, I guess, the passage is three books, but it's really just the world's longest book, just broken into thirds. This was part of what was going on in my mind, how human life, a human life, mine, for instance, or yours or anyone's, is this tiny flash in the vast sweep of time, both past and future, which is the occasion for great humility, but also wonder.
Yeah, and wonder is the word, because it's a strange thing to, on a horror podcast, talk about a book being in some way very wondrous and optimistic. And The Ferryman very much is. It filled me with optimism for the future, which is quite a rare thing to encounter in my reading.
Right, yeah, it's supposed to happen that way. I mean, you're supposed to, somebody asked me the other day in an interview environment, what's the dominant emotion that you want to have the reader come away with? And that was the word I came up with, because it was the word I had when I got, towards the end of the story, about which we can say nothing. what I was feeling was a sense of awe.
But and I'm not bullshitting you when I say that I did feel that awe. You've managed to bake into the sort of the last 100 pages of this book this kind of mind expanding thing that takes me back to, something like Kubrick's 2001, where it's like that kind of expansion of experience and imagination feels like you've somehow captured it in a way that I don't really know how you've done it, because you're still telling a very small human story. But you've mastered that in some way. And that's why I think the book is so good. And whilst we're on to talking about things like Kubrick and 2001, let's talk about inspirations, because this novel feels so firmly part of a canon of science fiction going back over the last 5 or 6 decades. And I was kind of listing references as I went, like Brave New World, Logan's Run, Soylent Green, Total Recall, The Matrix.
Yep.
The Truman Show, do you see it as part of that tradition? Were there specific texts that influenced you in the writing?
Well, everything you mentioned was sort of, with the exception of The Truman Show, which, believe it or not, I've never seen. People have been comparing this book to The Truman Show, and I have to go and watch it now so that I can get the reference. But everything else you mentioned was absolutely foundational text for me as I was growing up. I was born in 1962, so I became, a reader in some, real way starting in the early 70s. So these were the texts that I experienced. When you say Soylent Green, I'm like, oh, God. I actually just read a really interesting article about Soylent Green, which is part of the great triptych of the bare-chested Charlton Heston sci-fi movies of the era, Planet of the Apes, The Omega Man, and Soylent Green, right? And to your list, I would add most specifically Planet of the Apes.
Okay, yeah.
Which was probably the most important text of my childhood. Now, there's the French novel by Pierre Boulez, which I also read, but the original movie did something that this book is meant to do. And it is still possible. No, it's not, actually, because there are a million memes, but there was a time in life when you could watch the original Planet of the Apes without knowing how it ended. And I was such a person in 1972 or whenever it was. When I first saw that movie and I came to the end in that iconic image of the Statue of Liberty and Charlton Heston on his knees pounding the sand saying, "You maniacs, you blew it up," right? And then the camera turns around and you see the Statue of Liberty. You see it from behind first, and then you see Charlton Heston seen from above, and then the camera turns around and you see the Statue of Liberty, and all of a sudden 2,000 years of time is in that moment. Right. And retroactively, everything in this story suddenly makes sense in a way that you did not realize. Right. That's the kind of moment very specifically that I wanted to create in The Ferryman. That moment. And I don't know if I can use this language on your podcast. I'm pretty sure I can. Yeah. It was the ultimate holy shit moment. I always wanted to write something with a holy shit moment in it, where the reader literally screams, "Holy shit," and throws the book across the room in a certain kind of pleasure, you know? And I got that from that movie, which I saw when I was a kid. All the other books you listed, though, Brave New World, Logan's Run, all these things, I think I entered puberty just with watching Jenny Agutter in Logan's Run. And so these are all foundational texts for me, that kind of golden age of science fiction, both in books and in film.
And what you've done is written a book in which the shape of the narrative feels incredibly recognizable. When it starts, you understand this world just on an intuitive level from being baked in those right. references. But then you've somehow synthesized the details, which have kind of been done before in various guises, but you've synthesized them in a way that feels right. entirely new. And that's the magic trick that I don't know how you've pulled off. Because this should, on paper, if you lay it out like a blueprint, it should be a derivative novel, and it's completely not.
Right. There's a difference between me and other and certain other sort of genre writers in that I lean into that. I don't pretend for a second that this book has no antecedents. You know, I just kind of throw my arms around the antecedents because I love them. I love Logan's Run. I love 2001. I love Planet of the Apes. I love Bradbury. You know, all these. You know, the great fathers. They all happen to be male, but still, if I say fathers, the great fathers of my literary boyhood. You know, and I don't hide the facts. I don't pretend that I'm doing something totally new. What I do is kind of follow. Here's just Professor Pomposity for you. My philosophy kind of comes from T.S. Eliot's tradition and the individual talent, which is an essay that, you know, some people are acquainted with. It used to be kind of standard text for college English majors in the 80s. Which made a kind of interesting case for the fact that when you are writing, you are always working within tradition, and you are in fact making tradition as you do it. So I think the fact that I'm just honest about this helps me create a feeling of newness to, you know, material that in many ways we have seen before.
Okay, well, here I'm going to make a comparison that you may not have had made before, who knows. Despite all those references, the book that The Ferryman most reminded me of, and this may be weird, is Kazuo Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go.
Ding, ding, ding. Yep, that was absolutely on my mind.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, put yourself down for a raise, because he is a part of the tradition. You know, honestly, like when I sat down to write this and I said, I want to do it kind of like Ishiguro would do it, right? Because first of all, he's a very rich stylist. You know, he brings, you know, a tremendous virtuosity to language and to character. You know, if you look at Claire and the Sun and Never Let Me Go, they're both first-person narratives from people who live totally inside systems that to us are exotic, but to them are completely ordinary, right? But within those narratives, these are people who experience them entirely as if they are entirely ordinary, right? So I was very much thinking of Never Let Me Go when I wrote this. And I said this from the start, and my editor said it from the start.
All of those references we've mentioned, from Soylent Green to Planet of the Apes, etc., what they all have in common is this tension between truth and lies, or at the very least, truth and misconception about the nature of our reality. Now,
right.
I think it's safe to say that anyone reading this who's ever read a science fiction novel will know pretty quickly that all is not as it seems in Prospera, this idyllic island nation. I think, you know, without saying what the deal is, they'll know there is a deal. But right. do you...
they feel the deal, yes.
Do you, like me, think there is something truly contemporary and truly horrifically scary about that existential doubt?
Yeah, it's kind of the most unsettling thought that you can have, either personally or, you know, as a sort of culture-wide phenomenon. I mean, it wasn't too long ago that people introduced the idea that everything is a simulation, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a deeply disturbing idea that is forms the basis, for instance, of Emily St. John's Sea of Tranquility, right? What is the universe actually composed of? What is reality? We had for centuries systems of thought that were universally shared, i.e. religions, that answered this question for us. The deeper we go into science, the more mysterious reality becomes. I've been kind of waiting for the images from the Webb telescope to blow everybody's mind, right? And to sort of form the basis for a whole new understanding, or at least inquiry into the vastness of existence. The most unsettling thing to me, and this has always been true, is the idea of infinity, right? The idea of everythingness everywhere, all at once, in every direction. By the way, title for a very great movie. Even as a child, this idea sort of settled upon me as the source of sort of acute anxiety. And I began, oddly enough, when I studied mathematics in college, I finally just wiped out when we started manipulating infinity in equations. I think this was in vector calculus. All right, and I just found myself like existentially uncomfortable with it, and I started to fail. And that was the last math I ever took.
I wonder if it's something about writers, though, and infinity, because, you know, writers and creators of any kind have a need to fill voids with things and with patterns. So when you've got an endless void, it's almost like meeting the limits of your own imagination, which I think is quite a scary thing to a creative person.
Yeah, I mean, most writers are, you know, they're trying to fill some kind of internal void, the need to get beneath the surface of things, to find patterns. Life feels unpatterned. Ordinary life feels kind of arbitrary, poorly organized. It doesn't give up meaning very easily. Most of it is, you know, picking up your dry cleaning and standing in line at the movies. And writers and artists, I think, are people who may have an additional impulse to try to clear away the chaff and find sort of subterranean organization. They basically put life in order to reach conclusions about things. Stories have beginnings, middles, and ends. A human life does as well, but often its ending feels, you know, kind of arbitrary.
Badly structured.
Things to make sense. Yeah. Human life is, generally speaking, a very poorly written novel.
Yeah.
That's why we try to write good ones, right? To impose a kind of order on that so that we might see not just what, but if it amounts to something.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and you've nicely teed me up to come back to Never Let Me Go, because the reason that I said that this book reminds me most of that, above all the other references, is that you and Ishiguro introduce emotion into some pretty tech-laden science fiction in a way that a lot of texts right. can't match. They get over-fond of the architecture and forget the human.
Right.
I'm assuming you were conscious at all times of the importance of humanity amongst your high concepts.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the high concepts are always, you know, they're kind of boogeymen, the machinery. A book with a cool gizmo is fun. I really do like cool gizmo books. I'm reading, for instance, Chuck Wendig's Wanderers and Wayfarers, yeah. right? So, you know, he's written two books in the series. And he's a very good writer, and his characters are, you know, I'm trying to remember who used the expression warm new beings for a character. I think it might have been Margaret Atwood. Who, by the way, does the same kind of thing, right? I mean, she and Ishiguro are actually cousins. A Cool Gizmo is cool. I love a cool gizmo. I love time travel. I love monster stories. I love apocalyptic stories for a whole bunch of sort of dark psychological reasons. But the humanity of the story is the thing that really, I think, the readers most relate to. A book that's merely cool can be enjoyed and then put aside. A book that has sort of deeper humanity to it is one that maybe endures in memory. And that's kind of what I want to accomplish. I'm not really, I don't see myself as an entertainer, strictly speaking. I want to entertain. But the ways that I relate to books has always been one where I'm asking the book to help me understand my life.
Okay. So you're writing for yourself then, basically. Oh, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to participate in the tradition of writers who engaged in that project, right? And Ishiguro is a guy who absolutely engages in that project.
Is that why you said that your favorite genre is still the middle-aged meltdown genre?
Yeah, the male midlife crisis book. Well, it speaks to me, you know, although I'm technically kind of out of that zone. If I had a midlife crisis, like, you know, it's over by now. Or maybe just delayed and I haven't had the time to get around to it. But I do, you know, I look for books to tell me about myself. That can mean characters who are like me, but it doesn't have to. You know, nobody in Never Let Me Go is like me. But a good male midlife crisis novel, I just love. I mean, one of my favorite books of all time is a very quiet literary book, almost plotless, called Netherland by Joseph O'Neill, about a middle-aged Dutch commodities trader in New York City after 9/11, after his wife has left him and gone back to London, and he sort of falls into the company of a West Indian cricket team. You know, like, there's a kind of plot that is not a plot right there, but it's so nimbly and kindly unpacks the mind of a middle-aged man,
yeah,
who finds himself suddenly without reference points.
Yeah, well,
where the reference points drop away.
I mean, one of my favorite novels is called Shotgun Love Songs by a writer called Nicholas Butler, which is just sort of a really kind of indulgent sort of white man in his 30s wants to be a singer-songwriter. Isn't my life hard? I'm going to live in the woods for a year and almost die of frostbite. And, you know, it's, yeah. So I am open to a navel-gazing orgy myself now and again, you know. But I'm glad we're not talking about that today. Come back to this thing about humanity. This sounds like an obvious thing to say, but I mean something quite specific, right? A lot of the humanity in The Ferryman comes from the language itself. Of course it does. It's a book made of language. But what I mean by that is that Proctor, your protagonist, he narrates in this almost Victorian prose style.
Right, yeah.
Let me give the listener an example. And bear in mind that this is when he's describing quite a ripe scene with his soon-to-be reiterated, you know, killed and brought back to life father. This is what Proctor says. He says, quote, "It's ironic and a little sad that after decades of friendship and marriage and family and association, I am the only person left standing, like a last party guest who has failed to realise that his host is dressing for bed." End of quote, right? It's so dispassionate, it's almost robotic, it's like a Trollope novel. But somehow, despite that, you invest him with such pathos. I mean, is that something you were even conscious of? And if so, how did you manage it?
Well, I mean, I was absolutely conscious of Proctor as having a somewhat sort of kind of formal and old-fashioned narrative stance. I mean, it's never been compared to Trollope, but I take the comparison. It's also true that as the novel moves forward, there are places in which his language becomes substantially less formal. But he's a formal storyteller. You know, he begins this story by saying, you know, here's what I've called my life. Right? He announces his story in a very sort of formal and even old-fashioned manner. Just because of that, though, it doesn't mean that, you know, the scene that you just described, although it has a kind of, you know, formality to the language, is one in which he's realizing that his father only has him as he's moving on towards whatever counts as death in this world. And when when you lose somebody, when you lose a parent specifically, the solitude of that experience, we all kind of meet our maker alone in some way or close to it. That's a deeply human circumstance. And Proctor is somebody who is at that moment realizes it. So the language may have a kind of formality to it, but the sentiment that it describes is really, really human.
I've thought of a better comparison than Trollope, and again, it's come back to Ishiguro, and I'm thinking now of I can't remember the character's name, but the narrator, the butler in
Remains of the Day. Sure, I loved that novel. Yeah, I mean, again, a kind of novel of reminiscence. Like and he is very reserved.
But again, you piece together the meaning of things. I said this same thing on an episode a few weeks ago, but you piece through the meaning of everything in that book, in the things he doesn't say and the ways he doesn't react.
Right.
And I feel like the opening beats of this with Proctor feels like that. And then there's this lovely moment at the end of the first section after he's narrated these traumatic events in this aloof way. And then he just says, "Did I know? Of course I fucking knew." And it feels like a welcome release, you know? It's like, oh, okay, the story begins now.
Yeah. Right, yeah. No, I wanted that snap. That he begins in this kind of reserved, informal way, and then he just completely opens the kimono at that moment. And you realize the extent to which he's also a kind of noir detective across the length of the book. And you see gradually in his interactions with other people that he's actually a pretty forceful and opinionated guy and not the butler from Remains of the Day.
Yeah. The thing about him being a detective is interesting because essentially this is a mystery novel and it just happens to be this kind of existential mystery rather than a whodunit. I read an interview with you in the wake of The Passage when you were talking about finding the voice to tell that story. And if it's not too gauche to quote yourself back at you, you said this about it. I mean, years ago, you may have forgotten, but you said, "The voice was instant. And it had intimacy and scale, so it operated at both a highly localized omniscience and a 30,000-foot omniscience, which is how you get scale. You said you lift the camera and allow an intelligence behind the story that knows the end." And that's really interesting in light of The Ferryman, where the major structural conceit is that our main narrator doesn't know the end. He's as ignorant as we are.
The most important thing when you're writing a novel, I think, at least for me, right, is that I know how it ends. If I know how it ends, I can organize the story on behalf of that ending. I won't go down as many blind alleys. Every sentence has a reason, and the reason is the final sentence when you land the last moment. The Passage trilogy, as I said, was north of 900,000 words, but it wasn't long after I started the first book that I was standing in a supermarket parking lot picking up dinner when the last sentence of the whole thing dropped into my head. And not just like what the last moment was, but it's actual language, right? It's actual language. And so for the next, I guess at that point, about the next 7 years, I wrote towards that sentence. So the 30,000 feet doesn't come internally. It doesn't come from a character. They're down on the ground, right? But the 30,000 foot, the omniscience of the story, the godlike presence of the story is the storyteller who creates the narrator, who, whether that's first or third, and then tells it. And I learned this principle from a guy who told a great joke, and I heard him tell the joke several times. I was at a low residency graduate program where the faculty would all stuff into a dormitory for 10 days and give lectures and talks and readings and such while students were, they were taking classes, and then they'd go off and work with you individually. And so it was basically a bunch of adult writers at camp, and on the second night, this guy showed up, and he was a poet from Mississippi. And everybody, I was new to this group, and everybody said, "Oh, Brooks, tell the goat joke. Tell the goat joke." We're all sitting around the table. And he tells the goat joke. I don't even remember the goat joke. I know the goat joke is not the kind of joke that I could tell on a family podcast, right?
I think I know but the joke just from the punchline.
Yeah, right. To some extent, everybody does. So he told the goat joke, and it was hilarious and wonderful. And then during, across the length of the week, new people would show up, and everybody would say the same thing. They'd say, Brooks, tell the goat joke. So I heard the goat joke told a number of times. And each time he told it, two things happened. One, he told the hell out of it. It was like he was born to tell the goat joke, right? And also, each time he told it, it was a little bit different. He could have fun with the story. One night he could add this detail. The next night he could add that detail. Sometimes he'd tell it fast. Sometimes he'd tell it slow. He was a great natural raconteur. But the reason he could do this, and as I said, in old versions of this, this was a man telling the living hell out of a joke, right, was because he knew the punchline. He knew where he was going. He was the local god of the goat joke. And I think a novel, whether it's told in first or third, whether the characters inside it don't know what's going on or they do, the story needs a local god. It needs an intelligence presiding over it. And to some extent, this is also the subject of The Ferryman. And again, we can't quite talk about this, mm-hmm. but there's a moment where the story that I just told you about Brooks Haxton, the poet from Mississippi, who could tell the living hell out of the goat joke, there's a section of the novel in which a character actually sort of uses this same story to illuminate a principle, which is that reality as we experience it needs an author. It can't just be arbitrary. It needs a local god.
Yeah, that's a great anecdote to illustrate that point as well.
My joke is the bear joke, and I won't tell it on this family podcast.
Well, changing tack slightly, I've heard you say elsewhere numerous times that you aren't really a fan of magic as an element in fiction. Is that still true?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not what I read. It's not what I write. And by magic, I think I'm referring to not the kind of, magic that science provides, or the magic that is evident in daily life in inexplicable, even miraculous events, which do occur. I'm really talking about, waving wands and the way that a magic can come into a story and essentially be the ultimate deus ex machina of every moment in the story, where somebody can, cast a spell or wave a wand or all that stuff. For whatever reason, that just doesn't chime with me. And when I wrote that passage, I said, okay, we're going to use something rather like a vampire, but we're going to root it in science, the sort of casual science that I engage in. I'm not a scientist, where I'd say, okay, there's this mythology, there's this story of these, immortal beings who feast on blood. Almost every culture has some version of this, which I guess answers some kind of psychological need that we have. There are certain kinds of stories that for whatever reason we have to tell. But what if this is actually based on a real thing? Right? What if it's based on something real? So I took the vampire narrative and said, okay, let's tell the story of the real one, the one on which the magical stories are based, the Eastern European folktale, mm-hmm. that is generally speaking the kind of vampire narrative that in Western culture gets told and retold and retold and retold. There are, I think, two different Dracula movies coming out just in the next few months in the States and probably in the UK as well. One of them is a sort of black comedy about Renfield, mm-hmm. an interesting figure, the Dracula's the guy who picks up his dry cleaning, stuff like that. And then there's one about what happens on board the ship that brings Dracula's body across the sea. And I can't remember what that one is called, but I was only just alerted.
I think it's Voyager the Demeter.
Existence. Yeah, there you go. Right. And great stuff. One of them played as camp and one of them played as horror. The vampire as a character, as a figure, as a mythology is sort of endlessly interesting. It's sort of our best monster. Great. I'm happy with it. But I decided to kind of veer more towards the idea that if this was real, what would it actually be and how bad could it get? And the answer was it became a horror that wasn't a gothic horror. It became something else.
Okay, right. So forgive me. I'm going to push back a little bit.
Oh, no.
With a cliche as well, even worse. I want to throw a cliche at you because I get it, right? The passage, yeah, it's grounded. It feels grounded. But to paraphrase the old Arthur C. Clarke quote, sufficiently advanced technology, blah, 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 is indistinguishable from magic, right? And correct. When it comes to the ferryman, some of the machinery, to use your phrase from earlier, almost becomes an almost spiritual thing, you know? And so what I suppose I'm asking you is that, when you're writing a story like this, in your mind, at what point or how do you keep tech from being basically a wizard did it?
Yeah, and you, to some extent, you just kind of have to let it. I mean, you know, I grew up in an era of tube televisions and, you know, phones that plugged into walls and record players and all those things. And the idea of the iPhone, first of all, I assumed that by now I'd be living on Mars, you know. So, you know, I didn't expect Twitter would be my reward for living to age 60. But, you know, thanks a lot. What a terrible idea. But, you know, the iPhone, of course, is nothing anybody imagined, but is magic. Like, if I could step into a time machine and hand a fully functioning iPhone to my, say, 20-year-old self in you know, 1982, it would have indeed been indistinguishable from magic. What interests me in some ways is the degree to which technology simply gives us new ways, or it can, of contemplating things that are beyond science. And I used the example earlier in this interview, which was the Webb telescope, which traveling outside the orbit, the moon's orbit, had these, you know, these clear views of celestial events that are so vast and so beautiful and so terrifying in their immensity that organized religion, as it's practiced on a Sunday, suddenly seems obsolete to me. And technology can do that. Technology can open the door to mystical questions, not things of, not magic, not kind of extra physical systems that function as plot machinery, but sort of the great mysteries of the universe, the great mysteries. And that's the kind of stuff I like to play with. The idea of, I suppose, a God watched universe, like, you know, as a source of meaning, that like that you need it at some level. Things need to make sense. And the deeper we go into things like quantum theory or string theory and these sorts of things, the more the deep, deep, deep complexity of reality and of existence becomes sort of opens doors to, you know, sort of mystical thinking, the infinitely small and the infinitely large. I mean, these are the things that kind of obsess me at this age. I spend an awful lot of time taking walks at night, right? And looking up at the sky and realizing that when I look up at the sky, I am looking at an infinity of time and space, time in all directions, because of course, you know, you are actually, my mind can barely wrap around this, but of course, when you are looking at the sky, you are looking at all past simultaneously, because different stars, they look like they're existing in temporal concomitance, but they're not. You know, when you look at one star, the other side, the images that you're seeing are temporally different. And of course, you are looking at all space, and it's all there during the daytime. You kind of just can't see it. The daytime sky is full of stars that are not visible. But as I said, I take a lot of walks at night and look up at this and say, you know, someday I may go off to find, you know, maybe we all do, go off to find the answer to this great mystery.
Well, from that cosmic, you know, interstellar mystery, bringing it down to the closest thing to triviality in this story, but something that I found really chilling, right? You mentioned cool gizmos before. One of the elements in the story that doesn't feel a million years away is this idea of a wellness tracker, right? And every Prosperan, each person who's living in this bucolic paradise, is embedded with a tracker that numerically quantifies their well-being.
Yeah.
And if it drops below 10%, they're automatically sent to be reiterated.
Yeah, because life couldn't possibly be enjoyable, right? If you're like at 10%, like, yeah.
That's what I'm getting at. Because to me, that spoke to our, it's this thing that creeps me out about modern life. There's this modern lifestyle obsessed culture, the idea that sadness or ill health is aberrant and it's wrong and it's something that we must always be working to solve.
Oh yeah, completely. I mean, there is no art without suffering. There is no joy without, you know, fear and loss. The contrapuntal nature of existence, the constant existence of opposites sitting side by side, is the source of life's sort of bittersweet beauty, I think. You know, nobody wants tragedy, pain, sorrow. We don't. And there's reasons not to want it. I mean, it's no fun. But, you know, let's imagine a world in which we manage to banish all of those things. Right? Wouldn't that be sort of dead? Wouldn't that be a dead world? And, you know, the current vogue for what, for lack of a better term, is called self-care. The word self is the biggest word in that phrase. And, you know, that's self-care. You know, if we really just sort of said that word a little stronger, the idea would begin to seem maybe a little bit repulsive or at least like less attractive. And, you know, in Prospera, they all have this thing they can just plug into that will tell them not just about their physical health, but the idea of well-being, right? You are experiencing life in its fullest manner, right? Which is, of course, exactly what's not happening, right? You cannot experience life fully, say, without risk. People in Prospera do not have children. They adopt wards. These 16-year-olds walk off the ferry and they are adopted for their sort of final journey into adulthood, but the emotional connection that their guardians feel for them is fairly light because they haven't gone through this sort of death-defying anxiety, right? The incredible effort and work of having young children, which is probably the most terrifying human experience I can possibly imagine. They are merely kind of getting the benefits, that's sort of the triumphalism, right, of the later years of raising a child and skipping all the pain and anxiety, right? What kind of life is that? And the answer is easy, I guess, but it doesn't seem to be a life that feels, you know, truly rich and enriched by the collision of opposites.
And I think deep down we know that this endless pursuit for the perfect lifestyle is not only futile, but flawed.
Right.
Because I can't think of a single story that presents a painless utopia where it doesn't end up being that thing we started by talking about, where you pull back the veil and secretly, you know, the machinery running behind it all is a nightmare. It's almost like we know in our subconscious that perfection is a curse.
No, we do know it. I mean, we do. It's deeply, you know, embedded in the human mind. We're just a species like any other. I mean, we think we're awfully special, and it's true. We have opposable thumbs and language, and we can do all kinds of stuff that dogs and cats cannot. But we are, as I said, just a species roaming the earth until we stop, and we know what that means. We know what that means. All the technology in the world cannot solve the basic problem of being a person. We see that all the time. Every technology we come up with has got its dark side that is rather quickly revealed. I mean, the Industrial Revolution is, you know, slowly cooking the planet like a package of peas in a microwave. The iPhone, social media is digging these really treacherous sort of neural trenches in the minds of people who never lived any differently. I mean, that's sort of my philosophy, is that my kids who are, you know, grew up with these technologies, their brains are actually structured a little bit differently in ways that I'm not that happy with. So these things always, you know, technology always reveals itself in some ways to be friendly to lifestyle, but hostile to life.
I was going to sign off by asking you whether at the end of all of this, having written this, you would think it better to live in a misperceived reality and be happy, or live in the cold, hard real and be aware. But it sounds like you're very much for the awareness.
Yeah. Give me an analog world. I'll be happier in it, I think. You know, actually, no, I'm quite sure. I've sort of, I've reached a point in life where I've decided to just let myself be a dinosaur, because people are going to treat me that way anyway. I mean, I've reached a moment in life where capitalism is concerned only with my ability to buy pharmaceuticals and financial products. So, I'm just going to lean in.
Right, well, to draw this towards a close, I'm going to ask a question that will seem completely like a non sequitur to people who haven't read this book. But do you sail?
Yeah, I grew up on boats. Yeah, I grew up on boats. No, I mean, I hear something else. I think if you know something, if you know how to do a thing that a lot of people don't, you might as well use it in your fiction. And I love to sail. I love to sail. I don't have a sailboat now. I just sold the one I had. It was a little too sort of athletic, and I didn't have a crew for it. But I miss it, and I want to very much return to it. It is the ultimate analog experience.
And to explain it, I ask because the motif of sailing is so potent in The Ferryman. It feels like the truest representation of both freedom and autonomy in the book.
It's a pleasure, like few other things, and you don't have to know a lot to know how to do it. And it was handed to me when I was a kid. My father was a big sailor. It was one of the first things that that I did. The first lessons that I took outside of school were sailing lessons.
It's literally only dawning on me now that the sailboat that Proctor inherits from his father is a kind of yin to the yang of the ferry that he works for.
Right. Yeah.
The sailboat is light and lovely and agile and beautiful, where the ferry is this kind of utilitarian vessel. That's just dawned on me.
Yes, my ambivalence to motorboats. I mean, sailing is a kind of great alignment with the natural world. I mean, its method of propulsion is entirely based upon the atmosphere, and harnessing those powers. It's barely a technology, it's barely that. That was very deeply pleasurable. Whenever my characters got in a sailboat in this book, I was suddenly just a little bit happier. I've always said to my wife, it's kind of impossible to be unhappy on a boat.
And when that comes through in them, they are happier when they're in a boat for various reasons. But it is the sort of sense. I mean, there's a reason it's on the cover. Do you know what I mean? It's this central motif of all the good things that the story is working towards. Right. Well, listen, I've taken up a lot of your time. So to finish, can you answer my big two questions? First of all, Justin, can you recommend a book for my listeners and tell us why?
Yeah, I mean, this is a book I go back to because it was a foundational book from my young reading life, but absolutely holds up. It's sort of a touchstone for those of us who work in the apocalypse industrial complex. But it's a novel called Earth Abides by a writer named George Stewart. It was written in 1948.
Yeah,
And do you know the book?
I know it because it's the kind of agrarian apocalypse novel, right?
Right. It's quite stately. I mean, mankind makes a pretty orderly departure from the stage. I don't think the book contains a single firearm, used in anger. But it is a beautiful and dignified and philosophical novel about what becomes of the world when we leave it, and it holds up. It's got a like its gender politics are kind of right out of the Ricky and Lucy show. In the after the apocalypse, it seems like the job that is given to women is mostly handing out sandwiches. So in that regard, it has not aged well, but in every other way, I think that it has. And it was an early book for me, and I think I knew I wanted to be a writer at some unconscious level the day I closed the covers of that book.
It's part of a lovely sort of mid-century apocalyptic trend. There's things like that and a lot of Wyndham stuff and John Christopher's Death of Grass and Neville Shoot on the Beach and or it's a kind of different take on the apocalypse. Like you say, it's quite stately and it's non-hysterical. That's a good record. I honestly thought you were going to say Lonesome Dove, to be honest, because I every time I type your name in, it brings up Lonesome Dove.
Right. Well, are you aware of the thing I've been doing on Facebook lately with Lonesome Dove?
No,
We have a
what's that?
dog. We have no. This is, I, we have a dog celebrity now in our house. The dog that my wife rescued, who was near death. a month ago, been hit by a car on a busy highway.
Oh.
And when she took this dog to the emergency room, you know, it was just a stray, and they wrote stray on the form, you know, for its name. And my wife immediately said, no, no, that's not the dog's name. And I said, what's its name? And she said, it's Lonesome Dove. And Lonesome Dove is just outside my office now. She's making a good return to health. And I've been posting every day, just about every day on Facebook, as has my wife, this sort of story of this dog's miraculous, and I will add, incredibly expensive recovery. So there's that Lonesome Dove. But of course, the novel Lonesome Dove was very much a foundational book for The Passage, which, as I said, is a Western. But it was also the novel that told me that a book with a big plot and familiar and strong genre conventions could nevertheless be literature.
It's my second favorite book of all time. I read it over 4 days on a beach in Costa Rica, and it's one of my happiest memories of anything. I adore that book beyond measure.
Completely immersive.
Oh, and just one brilliant, truly brilliant book.
Yeah.
And if anyone hasn't read Lonesome Dove, if you think you don't like Westerns, go read Lonesome Dove, because it kind of rises above the genre like all the best books in the genre do. It's
right.
Masterful. Give my best to your wife, because that's wonderful. And we're a dog-friendly podcast here. I've got a mini dog celebrity of my own called Ted, who is all over my social media. So it's good to hear you doing nice things for injured dogs. Last question, Justin. What truly scares you?
What truly scares me? The sublime. All the things that I've talked about, right? The sublime scares me. The vastness of existence, the overwhelming largeness and indifference that you can see in the sky at night, or you can see, and here's, go back to sailing a little bit. Sometimes you look at the ocean and it's your friend, and sometimes you look at the ocean and it wants to kill you. Right? And you can see both of those things simultaneously, and it makes you feel both incredibly small, but also existing within great forces. And that's terrifying. That's terrifying.
That is terrifying. And that question, sometimes I think it must seem trite when I ask authors, because it's such a cliche, but I get answers that range from the universe and everything in it and the expanse of time and existence. And then other people, like a writer called Rachel Harrison, said garden gnomes. And the gamut of those answers is what makes that such a good question to ask.
Well, for reasons I won't go into, I'm deathly afraid of cotton balls. But, you know, that's a far less interesting answer.
Right. Well, I mean, everything you just said at the end there is kind of baked into The Ferryman. It's quite literally a book about everything from, well, everything we've talked about. I'm not going to try and condense it, because I'm going to spoil it late in the game. It's epic in every sense of the word, and I truly loved it. And I'm so grateful for your time. So Justin Cronin, thank you for talking Scared.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Right, straight off, The Ferryman is brilliant. Makes me laugh saying The Ferryman, because it makes me sound so English. The Ferryman, The Ferryman. Anyway, it's amazing. As I said in the intro, as I said in the conversation itself, and I'll say it again here, the beauty of this book is in how it takes this easily recognisable shape and tweaks everything just enough that you end up with something that, though its parts are all things you've seen before, as a whole, it feels very different. And if not different, just better. Justin seemed keen to avoid any easily labelling of his work under one genre, and I'm wholly behind that approach. But though The Ferryman would be most easily pigeonholed as science fiction, and it's certainly inspired by the classics, there is some real horror and awe at the core of this story, certainly in its big reveals. And speaking of those reveals, I hope we did manage not to spoil anything. Bear in mind that all the references to the many films and books that we mentioned in no way give away the specifics of what is going on in Justin's book. All of those stories are thematically linked in the ways we discussed, but none of them are anything like outright spoilers. So if you think you've worked out what is going on from listening to us talk, you probably haven't. That said, somehow, and I've got no clear idea how or why, I did manage to guess what was going on. And I can even tell you the exact moment that I realised it was the top of page 300 when the meaning of one specific word just seemed to clarify in my mind. I wasn't sure, and it was a good while before I got confirmation, but something clearly tickled the back of my brain into the answer. And I would love to know if and when you lot unpick the mystery. Hopefully, you can get right up to the most WTF moments in complete obliviousness, and I'm envious if you do. But if not, let me know when and how you worked out the secrets of this brilliant book. You can reach me at talkingscaredpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter, Instagram and sometimes TikTok at talkscaredpod. Get in touch, tell me your thoughts on the theremin, because I'm desperate to talk about this. Just to quickly reiterate my plea for support, because I'm not proud. Subscribe and review if you can. Numbers and kind words make a huge difference in my play to expand the reach of this podcast. Hopefully you'll see some good news on social media about this show this week. I'm not sure, but if you do, all success is down to you guys, and reviews are a big part of it. And if you do want more Talking Scared, the Patreon is there for you at patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. This week may have been a sort of sci-fi segue, but I'm back next week with a horror bullseye. It's Katrina Munro and her new novel, The Graveyard of Lost Children. Everyone, beware the black-haired woman. Until then, get out on the water, tell someone a good joke, and live like this is the only life you get. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.